344272, Willie Griffin versus Trumbull Insurance Company.
May it please the court, Steve Hicks on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Willie Griffin. I know that the court's very familiar with the facts of this case, but if I can just say at the outset, the no-fault law is designed for prompt payment of economic losses. That's one of its primary goals. Further, you're not supposed to need an attorney to represent you. In fact, we're obligated to tell clients that at the outset of every case that we handle, that they can handle it on their own, but if they need help, they can come back to us. So you don't need an attorney. And then the third thing is, you shouldn't have to incur substantial costs in seeking to recover these benefits. Because we have to remember that every cost that this plaintiff incurs in trying to get the PIP benefits they're owed, they're losing benefits. It's going to be deducted. If you have to hire an investigation firm to do a full investigation, whatever those expenses are, mm-hmm. at the end of the case, those come right off the top of your benefits. You don't get to recover those on top. So I say those three things about the no-fault law, particularly the fact that the goal is to be prompt payment of economic losses as the context for this case. I think it would be a mistake in this case to say that the question on appeal is whether the insurance company that insured the vehicle that was involved in the collision could be identified. I really don't think that's the issue here, although it may seem like that's the issue. The reason I don't think that is because the answer is so clearly no. Because when you review what both sides did in trying to find this particular individual from the accident report, the individual that was driving the vehicle, he's the only thing that's on that report, him and his address, are the only things that you have to work off, because that's all of the police officer put on the report. Both sides tried to identify that person. And so I think to say that the question in this case is whether he could be identified, he simply could not be identified. And that's absolutely fundamentally clear when in December, this accident happens in May of 2016, it's now been 3 years, or 3.5 years, that he has not received any benefits, even though he paid Trumbull for a premium.
Right, and Mr. Hicks, let me say, sure. I do think that the issue here is simply whether Harleysville was identifiable. I do believe that to be the issue, and it seems to me that the most sensible approach to this entire matter is consistent with the way we handle things like service of process, related situations. The point is getting a hold of someone, and the other side should be listening to me while I'm saying this, would be a due diligence test, which is not an absolute impossibility test. I mean, and for us to say that both sides didn't use due diligence is a little bit, wouldn't make any sense, because certainly everyone here, I mean, Trumbull's, sent an investigator with a subpoena. Yeah. I mean, it's not as though no one's trying here. People were trying, but the question is, was he identifiable? And I don't think he was.
So let me respond. See, I don't really think the question is whether he was identifiable.
Okay.
Because I think the answer is he was not identifiable, and their investigation shows that.
Okay.
So the question here really is, why didn't they pay? When they do this investigation, they hand it off. First, it starts with the adjuster. Adjuster makes calls. He hangs up on him. Doesn't want to talk. Then it goes to their special investigations unit, which they have. Special investigations unit puts an investigator on it who does exactly like you noted. Judge Krause goes out there, tries to find this person, goes to the address, and ultimately says, I can't find him. I can't get any information from this person. And they close the SIU investigation in December of 2016. At that point, there's no excuse for not paying. Sure, you may be a lower priority insurer, but he paid you a premium for coverage to protect him and to get his prompt payment of economic losses, and if it doesn't happen at this point, then they're on the hook for it. Now the argument on the other side falls in a couple different areas, but let me address each of them. First of all, they've made the argument that plaintiff's counsel didn't do enough.
Go ahead.
Just if I can respond to that.
All right.
He did what lawyers do.
Well,
he did what lawyers do, which is he sent a letter to Gonzalez saying, hey, turn it over to your insurance company. We all do that.
Never followed up.
And then, but what he did do is then identify every insurer in the order of priority and put them all on notice, including the assigned claims. So he's working this case. He's trying to get benefits paid.
Except
so it's not as if he sat on the file.
Well, okay.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I'd rather hear your question than me talk.
That's fine. Go ahead.
So, and then in addition, when he realizes in December, he also, of course, knows that because they've told him in a letter, hey, we're investigating. We're not paying right now, Trumbull tells him and his client. We're not paying right now because we're investigating. Fair enough. They investigate. They don't tell him in December that they close it, but they never pay. Come January, February, nothing's happening. He engages an investigation firm to search for whether this driver has insurance. That is also something that their investigator did, was try to identify, you know, does he own a vehicle? Does he insure a vehicle? Maybe he owned the truck. Those are the same things that their investigator tried to do. Unfortunately, it doesn't reveal anything, much like their investigation didn't reveal anything. Now, to the point that maybe he should have done something further, which I think is perhaps what you're suggesting, that he should have hired an investigator of own and sent an investigator out there to do the same things that Trumbull was trying to do. I would reiterate the point that the law is very clear that the lower priority insurer should start paying. The law was crystal clear on that point, and he could have done that. It would have cost his client in the end. You know, if he spent a couple thousand dollars in investigating this case, pay the investigator to go out there, a couple thousand dollars worth of wage loss out the window. It's not coming back to the client. And the point is here, he had this lower priority insurer to whom Mr. Griffin, paid $2,500 a year for coverage so that he would have protection. He's not someone that came that didn't have his own coverage. So I think certainly the argument they made is that he wasn't diligent enough. I don't think that's the case. I think he did what lawyers do. He wrote letters and he sued timely. He did send a letter to them and he did hire an investigation firm to research that issue of insurance. So I don't think that holds water. I think it especially doesn't hold water when you start reviewing their investigation files. Why would he have succeeded where they failed? Now, to the point that's also been made by defense counsel in their briefing, well, he could have sued earlier.
Yeah.
Because clearly what changed the tide here is that subpoena getting issued and this individual coming in to be
And he had to sue anyway. I mean, if you were going to depend on a lower tier insurance, and they're clearly not paying, and that, you've got a one-year back problem, You sue pretty quickly to get those monies paid because your client's not getting paid.
If I can correct that factually, though, the reason he didn't pay from May to December, and frankly even longer because they didn't change their tune anyway, is they told him, we're investigating. And there was investigation to be done.
So
you don't mean didn't pay, you mean didn't sue.
Yeah.
Huh?
You said didn't pay, but I think you meant didn't sue.
Well, they weren't paying. The reason he didn't file a suit
They knew that.
Is they're investigating.
And because they're investigating. Yeah. So what is he going to do, wait until the day before, the day after the one-year ruling goes, oh, we conclude our investigation, or the insurance company can say, well we're still investigating, and the attorney just sits back?
He's certainly not going to sit there and wait until the one-year back rule runs.
Well, he did. He waited until, five
until
days?
Just about, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
He filed on the eve of the one-year back rule. He had a calendared for that date.
And he didn't know who the insurance company was because the other place was investigating, even though they'd closed it, 5 to 7 months earlier.
Well, they didn't close it and tell him. They didn't never issued a denial.
Did they have even a duty?
To issue in a denial?
No, to issue anything without the demand. There's another insurance company out. I understand your problem here, but this attorney didn't do anything, and it's now your whole blame is on the insurance company, and I'm struggling where they have the duty to go out and find that higher priority insurance company unless you sued, and then all of a sudden they're on the hook, so it becomes imperative.
Which
to get.
You did, and let me address that.
What, not enough time to get your client coverage.
Let me address that. Well, he did it in time for the one-year back rule. He did it based on the fact that the case law is crystal clear that they are on the hook if that higher priority insurer could not be identified.
Which they ended up being identified, and so your client didn't get any money.
Let me explain why this guy was eventually identified. Because I think that's sort of the backdrop to this. It suggests that, if he'd been sued earlier and subpoenaed earlier, he would have just shown up. Well, the reality is, the reason he shows up is he doesn't work for Payvex anymore. Payvex didn't even report this to Harleysville, their insurance company. And he's hanging up the phone, not wanting to talk to anyone. It's only after he no longer works for Payvex that he gets a subpoena in the mail and he calls up the defense attorney and says, what's this all about? Do I have to do this? You know, and he shows up. So to assume that had a lawsuit been brought, he would have simply responded, I think really, misses the point that he had, by all indications, not, you know, I don't know what changed his tune, and we didn't certainly get into that, but I certainly suspect that he's no longer working for this company that didn't even bother to report it to his insurer. Now, whether he could have sued.
You keep wanting to look back, and I think you got to look forward. I mean, the client is injured. Mm-hmm. He's got 1 year to collect. They don't know, they only had a name and an address and a phone number for Mr. Gonzalez. Okay,
the bad driver,
okay? And so even assuming that all these other lower priority insurance companies are put on notice, your client didn't do anything until a couple days before the 1 year back rule. Now you're saying, well, we didn't know if Mr. Gonzalez was going to come forward. We didn't know this, we didn't know that, and we thought the insurance company was investigating. That doesn't have anything to do whether or not this insurance company could be identified.
I disagree fundamentally with the notion that he didn't do anything. he did exactly what lawyers do on these cases, and he relied on case law that says the lower priority insurer should pay if he can't identify it. No one could identify it in December of 2016, and that's the operative date they should have paid. Now, as to whether he should have brought a lawsuit, you know, he's not the only one that can get subpoena power. When they're stuck under the thumb of Michigan case law saying, oh, gee, we're the lower priority insurer, but we may still have to pay, they can file a deck action. They can subpoena this guy. Mm. Maybe he'll show up. Maybe he won't.
But they didn't. Why did they have to?
Pardon me?
Why didn't they have to? They could just sit behind their desk and wait until you blow the one-year statute.
Which he did not.
You did.
He did not blow the one-year statute.
Well,
he filed before He filed it against
well,
the
I think
timely
I, but what I think
no
I'm
no argument that he blew any statute of limitations as to this defendant.
Well, no, you filed in time, but not against the right person that needed to pay.
Because they could not be identified.
Well, that's the issue. You know, you started out this argument that is not the issue. That is the issue in this case. Is this insurance company identifiable?
So
is it identified? And what did you do to identify it? Because you're the one who has the burden.
I disagree with that, but
show me a case that says the insurance company, a lower priority insurance company, has the burden to identify an unidentified, initially unidentified,
well,
higher priority insurer. It doesn't exist.
Well, Levander's very close because
yeah.
In Levander they got exactly the trial court ruling you got here, and they got reversed. Why did they get reversed? Because the court said, that's a fact question on due diligence. So the court would, obviously
much,
it's
those
unpublished
are a lot more,
decision.
Yeah, and there were a lot more egregious facts in this case.
I'm not sure exactly how you mean
okay.
Egregious, but in terms
really
of in terms of
go ahead.
I guess I'd be happy to respond to that on the factual, but I don't understand the question.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
I think we're going in circles here. So.
No, that's fine. On the issue of diligence, I think he was diligent. I think they had an obligation to pursue it as well, which they did. And the reason an insurance company does that is because they are stuck on the hook as the lower priority insurer. The case law couldn't be clearer. Regents versus State Farm, which they acknowledge in their brief, says we could be on the hook for owing attorney fees on this if we don't pay. We take that risk. So basically, by issuing the ruling that you're suggesting, you're basically saying that it's appropriate for them, with a premium paying insured, to say, we're just going to sit on it. We're going to sit on it. We don't, you know, we've done our investigation. We've closed our investigation. But never you mind, we're not going to start paying benefits. That is contrary to everything the no-fault law stands for. And it's the no-fault law that puts that burden on them. And that's been clear for decades. But in any case, I see if I have a couple other points. I think I've covered everything I want to cover. With regard to the Michigan Assigned Claims Plan or the MAIPF, however we want to style that, he did also sue them. He did also put them on notice because he was getting, you know, no response from Trumbull. And I think we have a disagreement with regard to the statutory language and how it applies in this case. I've outlined that in my brief, and I think it's important to note that the MACP is really the only one that has a more generous ability to recover. If the MACP ends up having to pay, if that's where this court ends up, they actually can go back against how it is, because the statute's more forgiving for them in terms of doing that. So in terms of the tube being out of the toothpaste, it can be put back in this issue if the MACP is held responsible. With regard to the sanctions issue, I'll just stand on what's in our brief. I do think that if the court reverses, there should be a sanctions hearing because they just simply did not disclose and weren't candid with the court about the investigation that they've done. So that's all I have. Hopefully I have a few minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, yes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Sydney Klingler appearing on behalf of Defendant Appellee Trumbull Insurance Company. I think the issue clearly is whether or not Harleysville, which is undisputedly the highest priority insurer in this case, was identifiable by the plaintiff. And I think clearly Harleysville was identifiable. Plaintiff's counsel sent a letter to Gilbert Gonzalez, the driver of the truck that was involved in the accident, 5 days after the accident. So counsel says that plaintiff shouldn't have to have an attorney to find the highest priority insurer, but he did in this case, 5 days after the accident. Then for 11 months, that attorney, when that letter, by the way, didn't ask about the ownership of the truck, anything about the truck, and it didn't really ask Mr. Gonzalez to call back. It said something about further word. So that letter was sent out 5 days after the accident. Plaintiff's counsel did nothing for 11 months after that.
Well, Brother Counsel said that he contacted Trumbull, and Trumbull said they're investigating, and he reasonably relied on that, didn't file suit in a timely fashion. So it's your fault.
Well, I mean, and I don't think he's saying that. I don't think it's fair to say he did nothing. At least based on the argument of counsel and what is in his brief, it doesn't seem like he did nothing. It's not like he just sat there. I mean, he knew there were other things going on, like your investigator going out with the subpoena, right?
That was after the lawsuit was filed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That was revealed in discovery after the lawsuit. So I don't know if he was aware of Trumbull's investigation informing him that it was investigating. But I think that
it was before the lawsuit, right? Was filed that you sent out the investigator?
Yes.
Okay, I was going to say.
Yeah, but not the subpoena.
The subpoena was obviously issued after the lawsuit.
Yeah, okay.
But to your question, Judge Kelly, I think it's as you suggested in your questions to Mr. Hicks, it's the duty of the plaintiff to identify a higher priority insurer. And he did do nothing for 11 months. He sent out a letter and then didn't do anything to identify Harleysville, the insurer of the owner of that truck that was allegedly involved in the accident. What could plaintiff have done? Plaintiff could have filed suit, and then he would have had the subpoena power to produce Mr. Gonzalez who quickly, once he was produced after the lawsuit was filed at the 11th hour, he was produced. He quickly revealed that he was employed, had been employed by Pavex, and it was then quickly determined that Pavex's insurer was Harleysville. So the plaintiff could have filed suit. He could have filed suit after 4 months, after 5 months, after 6 months, and he would have had ample time to determine who to find Harleysville. I did want to mention the case of Maroki versus Encompass Indemnity. It's mm-hmm. an unpublished case cited in our brief. And that case says it's instructive on the fact that a claim against a higher priority insurer, the fact that it's time barred, doesn't mean that the lower priority insurer is automatically liable. The court said plaintiff's error doesn't change the order of priority. Plaintiff's error in this case was to fail to take action and file suit, identify Harleysville. That doesn't make the lower priority insurer liable. Plaintiff claims that Trumbull was obligated to pay PIP benefits because there was a priority dispute. There was no priority dispute. It's undisputed that Harleysville is the highest priority insurer here. And furthermore, that no claim was ever made to Harleysville, and Harleysville never denied a claim. There's no priority dispute.
And they were not a party.
They're not, no. As far as sanctions, I think sanctions are completely unwarranted. The court, in the first place, should affirm the trial court's determination that Harleysville was rather easily identifiable, as defense counsel did with ease once a lawsuit was filed, that plaintiff could have filed a lawsuit and done the same thing, identified Harleysville easily.
Or if they couldn't have identified him, your client would have been on the hook as a lower priority, right?
Well, we're lower priority. How would we be on the hook?
Well, if they couldn't find Harleysville and Harleysville remained unidentified,
unfindable,
yeah, then you're on the hook.
Yes, there is case law that says it. Frierson,
yeah,
which I'm aware that Your Honor was on that panel.
Yeah, okay.
So
I know that there's something out there that
there's
supports
case law that
says there
that.
Is case law.
Yes,
there.
But I think sanctions are totally unwarranted in this case. First of all, plaintiff had the information that they're claiming was so critical. They had it before our summary disposition motion was filed. For whatever reason, they didn't rely upon it in response to our summary disposition motion. But they did put it in front of the court in a supplemental brief. So point number two, the court was also well aware of that information. But finally, and I think really getting to the point of the sanctions argument, is that our argument was well-founded in fact that Harleysville was easy to identify. And Harleysville was easy to identify by filing a suit and using the subpoena power to produce Mr. Gonzalez. That was done by the defense counsel with no great difficulty and could have been done by the plaintiff. So for those reasons, our argument.
So then what you're saying is that if he had filed the suit earlier, then he would have found Harleysville earlier.
That's right.
Okay, so what is the case law that says he's required to file the lawsuit before the 1 year? Tell me where that is, because I don't see that.
I don't have a case to cite for that.
Right, I'm because there isn't.
He could have.
He wasn't required to. Right?
Right, but at the risk of losing the entitlement to sue that insurer. That higher priority insurer.
No, I think we disagree. Yes, we're going to disagree, and that's okay, because I think you're probably going to win anyway, because I think these two are going to disagree with me. So, but we'll see.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Now you go ahead. You start.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Naraki appearing on behalf of the defendant, Michigan Assigned Claims, in this matter.
And let me say, and this is, I want to be, in all fairness, I think that your argument is very strong, and I do think that it is a reach to say that you are responsible in some way here. I will listen to what Mr. Hicks has to say in rebuttal to that, but I think this is a tougher part of the case.
Well,
for the plaintiff.
I'm not sure you need to.
Yeah, I'm not sure you have to really talk.
Victory.
All right. Well, I'll just mention one thing. As I sat here listening to the questions and the arguments, a couple of things popped in my mind.
Sure.
And it's just regarding the issue that's been focused here, whether or not due diligence was used. The facts are what they are. You have them in front of you. You know what the plaintiff did. You know what Trumbull did. It's undisputable that at the time that the lawsuit was filed, even 1 year after the lawsuit, Harleysville was not identifiable. Everything that Trumbull did, everything the plaintiff did, nobody could find them. Does Trumbull have a duty to do an investigation? And I don't know of any case law that says that they have a duty to do that, but they did the investigation, and it was a pretty thorough investigation and couldn't find anything. So 1 year after the accident, nobody knew about Harleysville. We take the deposition on October 23rd of 17. We subpoena Gonzalez. Gonzalez shows up. I question him. He discloses Pavex. And after the deposition, I immediately called Pavex right from plaintiff's office from my cell phone and learned that they're insured with Harleysville. So it wasn't until October 23rd of 17 that anybody found Harleysville. Mm. One last thing I want to say is, it was brought up that if plaintiff would have filed this lawsuit earlier, he would have obtained subpoena power. He could have got Gonzalez's deposition and found this out earlier. Possibly, but that's speculation. We don't know that if Gonzalez would have shown up for that deposition.
Well, he'd certainly be in a much better position to hold Trumbull liable.
I agree.
There you go. So
with that, I agree. Okay. Regarding, I guess, my issue with the claim against the Michigan Assigned Claims Plan, I mostly rely on my brief. 3172 states when you can come to the plan for benefits. In this case, there has to be a dispute between two insurers. I don't think there was one. Obviously, Trumbull is in the case. No claim was ever made with Harleysville. Harleysville was never brought in as a defendant, and we don't know Harleysville's position. Now, will they say, we have no liability because of 3145. We were not put on notice within a year. I don't know. Purely speculation, purely conjecture as to what Harleysville would do. I can tell this panel.
I don't think they'd pay.
They may.
And you think so?
And this is the reason why. This is what I was just going to state.
All right, go ahead.
I represent the MACP. They're one of my larger clients. I deal with this frequently.
Okay.
And once they learn about the MACP and that we have subrogation rights against the highest insured priority, that they'd be responsible to, not subrogation rights, but reimbursement rights, that they'd be responsible to reimburse us everything, plus interest and loss adjustment costs, et cetera. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes they think that it's in their best interest that they should just take over adjusting the claim at that point instead of paying the assigned insurer to adjust their claim. Unless you have any other questions.
Any questions? No. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I just have a couple quick things I wanted to address in rebuttal. First of all, with regard to the Meraki, the other unpublished case that she cited, if you read the case carefully, what happened in Meraki is very different than this case. In that case, the plaintiff's attorney got it wrong on legally. It's a bobtail coverage case, very complicated case. The law was arguably a little unsettled, but fundamentally, the attorney didn't protect his client by suing because he legally got it wrong and didn't understand the law. And the court in that case said, yeah, that doesn't get you anywhere. So it's a completely different issue. And I think it's important that you recognize that. I don't think it may stand for the proposition that sister counsel said, but the facts are so different and the underlying reasoning is so different that it doesn't make sense to apply it in this case. Lavander, on the other hand, is directly on point with this case. And what happened in Lavander is the trial court issued a similar ruling and the Court of Appeals reversed, saying, you know, you really have to have a determination of whether it was diligent, the actions that were taken in terms of finding this other driver's involvement. In that case, the insurance company evidently took a statement from a vehicle driver behind the individual that was injured, and it implicated their involvement in the collision as well. They didn't reveal that, that was not received by the other side. So that was the issue in that case. But basically, fundamentally, they were stuck on the issue that, yeah, there's a fact question on that. You really have to have a factual determination. I don't think we can say as a matter of law that this person could have been identified in that case, because it was really the insurance company that got this information. I think the same is true here, is certainly true here. The court is obviously, several judges have discussed things that the plaintiff could have done, and defense counsel has illustrated that well. But the fundamental question was this insurer identifiable? What happened after they closed out their SIU? Because clearly in December of 2016, it appeared that we weren't going to get this guy.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, because then I should have asked opposing counsel from, and I always use the wrong initials, MACP, I got it. I should have asked him, because, I mean, he actually argued that Trumbull should have paid in his brief. So,
yeah.
I mean,
I think he agreed. He fundamentally,
I mean, there's only one person here who thinks that Trumbull shouldn't pay, and that's Trumbull.
Yeah. And the you know, obviously we both have an incentive in doing that,
well,
respective incentives. But the reason is that they did this investigation, they closed it out. They also decided, we can't get this guy. They closed their investigation and did nothing at that point. The question here is, why don't they pay at that point? Why is their response, you have to sue us? Even though you paid us a premium, you've got to sue us if you want to get money from us. That is fundamentally antithetical to the No Fault Act and prompt payment of economic loss. At that point, this guy had waited 6 months to get his benefits paid, and he just keeps waiting. So that's all I really have to say in response. I would encourage you to look at the Levander case, because I think they got it right there. It is unpublished, but I think it's worthy of consideration, so I hope that you'll do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Harris.
Thank you so much. Thank you to all three of you. Even if I pick on someone sometimes, I think you all are great lawyers and did a great job. So thank you very much. All right. And I already called number 20.